Reading National Geographic, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation with anthropologist Catherine Lutz, co-author of Reading National Geographic, a new account of national identity and popular photography.
In the marketplace of images, National Geographic relies on two intertwined strategies. It relies on recognition, on offering readers what they already know and believe, but in new and appealing ways. Its reputation and sales also turn on the classic humanism with which it portrays the world. At the same time, the Happy Speak policies of National Geographic have meant that for people of color, as for others, the overall picture is one of tranquility and well-being. One photographer expressed this discrepancy poignantly, pointing to a photograph of an African family in a 1988 issue on population. "The story is about hunger," he said, "but look at these people. It's a romantic picture."
Anthropologist Catherine Lutz. She'll be back in just a moment to talk about Reading National Geographic, a new book she co-authored about national identity and popular photography. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. The National Geographic is an American institution. For millions of people today, the Geographic opens a window on exotic cultures and places. Over the last 100 years, in fact, the National Geographic has been a steady source of information and images about places and cultures beyond American borders. But the Geographic doesn't consist only of travel writing and pretty pictures. Incorporating scientific and educational dimensions, it strives toward the journalistic ideals of objectivity and balance. According to the authors of a new book about the National Geographic, the magazine also invites readers to become comfortable strangers with faraway peoples and locales. The book is Reading National Geographic. It's the work of two anthropologists, Catherine Lutz and Jane Collins. Catherine Lutz teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Jane Collins at the University of Wisconsin. They say that the National Geographic recognizes universal values while concurrently celebrating cultural diversity. They also note that the Geographic has shaped a sense of national identity that cuts in at least two directions. As America's lens on the world, that is, the Geographic teaches us about distant cultures. But in doing so, it also tells us a lot about ourselves. As a result, according to Lutz and Collins, the magazine reflects a fundamental tension between our desire to learn about other peoples on the one hand, and on the other, our desire to affirm middle-class American attitudes toward race, gender, privilege, and progress. With an excerpt from Reading National Geographic, here is Catherine Lutz.
In a July 1968 photograph, an Inuit woman wearing a fur-trimmed parka stands in front of a washing machine. "Unfamiliar luxury," the caption says. A washing machine draws a housewife to the new Tuck laundromat, which also offers hot showers. This picture is deliberately structured around the contrast between the pre-modern and the modern, with the evaluative balance falling to the luxurious present. It might have still resonated for readers with the image from 1959 of Nixon and Khrushchev arguing over the benefits of capitalism next to a freshly minted washing machine and dryer at the American National Exhibition in Moscow. In those debates, Nixon could argue that the progress of American society under capitalism is found in its ability to provide labor-saving devices to women. "I think that this attitude towards women is universal. What we want is to make easier the life of our housewives," he said. In the gender stories told during the Cold War, family life and commodities provided what security was to be found in the post-Hiroshima, post-Holocaust world. The non-Western woman, too, could be deployed as proof of capitalism's value, of the universal desire for these goods, and of the role of women in the evolution of society.
Catherine, we're talking about Reading National Geographic, your book with Jane Collins. This book has, in part of its origins, a political moment in your personal life. Tell me about that.
Yeah, Jane and I, like many people who grew up in the 50s and 60s, were profoundly affected by the Vietnam War, and often it was the photographs of that war that had that kind of influence on people's political understandings of themselves and America's place in the world, and mm-hmm. so on.
Now how did you get to the National Geographic? That seems like a bit of a leap.
Well, both of us as anthropologists were also teaching undergraduates and teaching them about people around the world, and we found that people in our classes often had some pretty strong ideas already about who was out there and what they wanted and how they were living. And we were interested in finding out how people had gotten that kind of information. And one of the primary sources by which people get that in this society is National Geographic magazine for mm-hmm. the last 100 years. And so we thought it would be a good place to start.
Catherine, talk to me about your book, Reading National Geographic, and what we might call the myth of objectivity, getting it right, getting it accurate.
Yeah, I think this is an important feature of a lot of American journalism, which is the idea that what they're about is painting an objective picture of the world, of a particular news event or more general background story. And the National Geographic, like a lot of American journalism, thinks that the way you present an objective viewpoint is by presenting the bad part and the good part, the mm-hmm. left and the right, the old and the new, and between all of those ends of the dimensions, you will find the truth.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's a fallacy. And
is that because you're an anthropologist and you don't believe that there is such a thing as objectivity, or what's behind that assumption?
Well, it's the assumption that history and truth are too complex for that kind of simple formula.
Mm-hmm.
That in fact, if you want to understand what the critique of American journalism can do, the critique of American journalism has to focus on why certain images, ideas, stories get circulated. Obviously, this is an institution that is predicated on the notion that if the market drives all news production,
uh-huh.
something's lost.
Uh-huh.
And that's part of the critique of the Geographic and of American journalism that's in our book.
How was your effort in writing this book, Catherine Lutz, you and Jane Collins of the University of Wisconsin, how was it received at the Geographic itself? I mean, you couldn't keep the fact a secret that you were writing this book. Did the people at National Geographic cooperate with you?
Well, the way we did the study was to, we focused on three things. One was the institution itself, mm-hmm. and we went to the headquarters and were shown around through the production process and interviewed several photographers and picture editors and others who put the magazine together.
Mm-hmm.
The institution was very gracious in allowing us to do that. We then also looked at the magazine itself. We looked at 35 years of the issues most closely, and analyzed the patterns in that corpus. And then thirdly, we interviewed readers, a group of 56 readers in several parts of the country, asking them to look at a random selection of photographs, relatively recent photographs from the magazine, and to tell us what they saw in the pictures.
Mm-hmm. I believe at one point in the book you say that did I read it in the book or in one of the reviews of the book, that people actually look more at the pictures than they do the text. They don't read the words so much in the National Geographic as they scan it for the images there.
Right, a large segment of the reading public just looks at the photographs. Another additional segment looks at the photographs plus the captions, and then mm-hmm. A smaller subset reads some of the articles.
And yet you call your book Reading National Geographic, yeah. not just looking at it. So I take it that you give some serious consideration to the text itself in the magazine.
Well, one of the reasons we use that is not so much because we pay attention to the text. We focus very much on the photographs. It's because we see the photographs as telling a story.
Uh-huh.
Photographs have a narrative structure. Juxtaposition of photographs can tell a story, and the Geographic is very much attentive to how that will play out with readers. And so we're talking about reading the photographs. One of the things we did was to take a random sample of the photographs from the post-war period to ensure that we weren't just selecting photographs that represented a skewed mm-hmm. subset of the whole.
And you use what, 600, 700, 800 pictures?
600 photographs, uh-huh. one from each article on non-Western people mm-hmm. through the period. And we looked at those very systematically. We had two people coding each of the photographs for a variety of features of the photograph, who was in it, what were they doing, from what vantage point was the picture taken.
Right.
And those codings of the photograph, I think, help us to, again, take a perspective on it that is not obviously objective, but is more careful.
Are you going to take all the fun out of this magazine for people? I mean, you're coming to it with a political commentary and a sort of cultural commentary. The National Geographic isn't just an innocent travel magazine?
No, it's not. And I think, though, it can be more fun to read if one looks at it with a critical perspective and says, this magazine tells me more about the world than I think it does.
Uh-huh.
It tells me about myself and my society.
Yeah, this is one of the issues that is central to your discussion here. That is to say that people read the National Geographic thinking that they're going to learn about other cultures, and really what we're doing is learning about ourselves. Unpack that mm-hmm. for me a little bit.
Well, the magazine is selling photographs, which are always thought of as objective documents, but I think we, in looking at the magazine, have found that there is many ways in which there's a selection process at work, and that selection process is one where, for example, the photographers come back with 11,000 frames on average for one article, and the editors can choose 40 or so pictures from that, and in that process really have a lot of leeway to construct a particular image of a country or a place. What's distinctive about the magazine is that it presents the third world in a way that's quite idealized and often focuses on the exotic mm-hmm. rather than the mundane. And some of this comes out of editorial policy. In 1915, Grosvenor, one of the original editors, promulgated a policy in which he said that nothing of an unkindly nature will be printed about any people or nation.
Now let's pause on that word unkindly. I mean, that really carries a lot of baggage with it, does it not?
Right. The point was to not sell negative images, not sell pernicious and racist images.
Mm-hmm.
And that policy has been followed through on. But what we get then from that kind of policy is a picture of people that's very positive, it's upbeat. Through the century, there's been relatively little focus on the realities of war or poverty or hunger.
What you're telling me here, Catherine, is that the National Geographic in a fashion functions analogously to our theme parks. We are confirming and re-exploring and enjoying certain myths about ourselves and about other people. Is that too far-fetched?
No, I think that's a good way to put it. There's, I think, an audience. We constitute an audience as Americans who have certain kinds of desires when it comes to looking at the world. We'd rather not be confronted with unpleasant facts.
When you say Americans, I mean essentially you're writing in this book. You and Professor Collins are writing about a white middle class American reader.
Right.
Why is that important to your considerations?
Well, that tends to be the audience of the magazine. It's 97% white readership. It's a huge readership, so it runs across all kinds of ethnic and class boundaries. People from wealthier families, from more impoverished families will see the magazine and even sometimes subscribe. But it's really primarily, the bulk of the audience is white and middle class.
I think I read one of the reviews of your book that it's an astonishing number. 37 million people a month will see the National Geographic?
Right. It's America's most popular magazine, it says, even though it's actually third in subscription rate.
Catherine, let's talk about photography and the National Geographic. You use a wonderful phrase here, you and your co-author, the photograph as an intersection of gazes, G-A-Z-E-S. What do you mean by that?
Well, we look at the photograph, and I think in almost any photograph, not just National Geographic photographs, one can see several ways in which looking is embedded in the photograph. There is obviously a photographer's lens through which someone has looked and chosen a scene. There's a caption that tells us to look again at the photograph in a particular way uh-huh. and focus on some things and not others. There is a reader who interprets both the caption and the picture as taken through the lens. And there are people inside the photograph who are looking sometimes back at us, sometimes beyond the frame at something else, sometimes at each other in a group photo. And all of that, those lines of gaze, can tell us a lot about what the story of the photograph is intended to be or could be.
Now, you're implying a kind of a very dark ideological picture here. Your manipulation is one word that comes to mind. Unpack this for me. Attack and defend as is necessary.
Well, I don't think it's really often intended at all. The photographers and the picture editors at National Geographic are doing the work of selecting photographs and taking them without necessarily being highly aware of what it is that they're choosing and preferring in photographs. They'll look at photographs and choose one over the other with a sense that it's just a better picture, uh-huh. without necessarily articulating to themselves or to others why it's a better picture.
Let's be very specific and concrete. One of the photographs that you refer to is of a Native American woman in a laundromat. So what? Why can't we simply innocently look at this picture and pass by it? What is the message, or why is it freighted?
Well, this picture was chosen out of that large number of other possible photos, in part, I think, because it does the contrastive work of talking about the difference between a traditional world and a modern world.
Uh-huh.
The washing machine standing in for modernity and the woman with her fur-lined parka standing in for a view of a traditional world.
And we come away with this with what some false sense of disparity or progress at work here?
No, I think it's not a case that the picture doesn't represent something that actually happened out there, but rather what's interesting is how often pictures of that sort get published and are popular, mm-hmm. with readers. And I think the reason they're popular is because they appeal to pre-existing ideas that we have learned, ideas about social evolution. And those ideas are ones in which there is an imagined historical trajectory in which all people go from a traditional lifestyle to a modern one.
Mm-hmm. It's also a way to recognize what we call the primitive in ourselves and other societies. Is that too far-fetched?
Well, I think, let me just answer that by telling you about something I just received in the mail a little while ago,
mm-hmm.
which was a copy of American Naturist Association's magazine. And this is the Nudist Society of America.
Sure.
And they had just published an issue a couple of months ago in which they featured some mock-ups of American magazines on their cover, one of which was called the Natural Geographic. It had a yellow border, but there was a naked white woman and baby on the cover.
Uh-huh.
And the title of that article, the hypothetical article, was Naked White People of North America. The play there on the idea that the Geographic depicts nudity in everyone but white people. Again, the code being that this would become pornography if we were looking at white women.
We've got to have that distance, don't
right.
we? What about the issue of race, Catherine? You write about race as a component in your book, Reading National Geographic.
Well, that is about race.
Mm-hmm.
It's simultaneously about race and gender.
Yes.
The fact that certain photographs become publishable and others aren't. Another famous incident that has been reported by other people who know about the Geographic, is one in which a photograph of some Polynesian women was en route to being published. I believe this was back in the 60s. And the editors felt that her skin was too light. She was a mixed-race woman. And they darkened her down in the production process in order to make her more acceptable to an American audience.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you just a very blunt question. Is the National Geographic, or has it ever been over the course of its history, a racist kind of, has it ever adopted what you as an anthropologist would call a racist editorial posture?
Well, I think the point again about the book is that we're dealing with American society primarily, and the magazine only, in a sense, secondarily, even though that's the ostensible subject of the book. So to the extent that we can say that America is a racist society, and obviously we have to say that, it's not possible to say that the Geographic hasn't been circulating in images that can be taken in ways that aren't progressive.
So when you say that reading National Geographic is a reflection of American eyes and the American, oh, for lack of a better term, the national character, you are not talking about editorial policies. You're not talking about one person at a magazine making decisions that shapes a worldview. You're talking about America itself.
Exactly. And even the institution has many different people working to produce the final product. There
uh-huh.
are caption writers, there are layout people, there are photographers, picture editors. All of those people have sometimes discrepant ideas about what the magazine should look like.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are struggles within the institution over that. And then there is a very diverse audience, obviously, amongst those 40 million readers who have different ideas about race and gender and American politics and the place of America in the world. And so out of that rich stew of differences, you find, I think, still a story that can be told about a relatively similar set of ideas that many people have had to have articulated.
You talk, for instance, Catherine, about, it's a 50-cent term here, but let's put it on the table nonetheless, a conservative form of humanism that the National Geographic confirms for its readers. And you take issue with that. In what way?
Well, I think what the argument that Jane Collins and I are making there is that the photographs often appeal to the notion that we're really all the same under the skin, the notion that we are all interested in the same kinds of things, the same kinds of family values, the same kinds of lifestyles and commodities, a certain kind of standard of living that comes with having lots of things.
In other words, commodities. And you're saying what? We are not the same under the skin, or under the surface of these different costumes that we wear?
Well, I think we're obviously both the same and different from people around the world. And what's, I think, helpful is to think about the ways the photographs might direct our attention away from some of the differences of interest that we have with other peoples as members of one nation state, relatively wealthy and powerful. And to focus on those similarities is helpful in combating racism, but to focus on them to the exclusion of paying attention to conflicts of interest is, I think, less than helpful.
Well, now, is it fair to say, Catherine, that there is always going to be, in the most innocent of pictures, a political dimension or a cultural bias at work that carries a message or that is secretly trying to persuade the readers of National Geographic to think in a particular way about a particular culture?
Yeah, I think every photograph, every word written about the world has that rhetorical dimension to it.
Mm-hmm.
Looking out at the world and seeing poor, hungry people can be an upsetting kind of experience. It's one that can raise the issue in some people's minds of whether or not we deserve to be where we are.
Mm-hmm. Now, we don't want to make this picture completely lopsided. I mean, at one point in your book, the title of which is Reading National Geographic, you and Jane Collins talk about a shift that occurred at the National Geographic. That is to say, the Vietnam War, and you mentioned this earlier in our conversation, this was a moment when we really began to rethink American perspectives on other societies. Unpack that one for me.
Well, I think that the Geographic responded to some of those cultural changes, which came with Vietnam and with decolonization, with the independence of African and Asian states. And that was a period in which many Americans came to question our power, our place in the world, the extent to which we were really at the head of a modernizing, civilizing mission.
Mm-hmm.
And so those questions were filtered into the National Geographic magazine in certain ways. One can look at the Geographic's coverage of the Vietnam War itself.
Hmm.
Around 1968, it suddenly evaporated. There had been many issues on that, on the war and on the country. And it was an issue, obviously, that was highly politicized in 1968. Many readers had very strong opinions about the war, one way or the other. And the Geographic's response was to step back from the issue altogether. If there were no pleasant or non-controversial terms in which to present the war, then best not to cover it.
We go back to that word kindly as a kind of an editorial watchword in the composition of the Geographic.
Right.
Uh-huh.
But then later in the next decade, in the 70s, a generation of new photojournalists and journalists came to the magazine and wanted to modernize it and wanted it to be a more realistic kind of journal. In addition, readers were becoming more accustomed to seeing harsher images of the rest of the world in other places. And so the Geographic was coming to seem more out of date, more inaccurate. And so the magazine began to change. There were more frequently images of hunger or war.
So the ironic upshot here is that as the magazine recognized the grim realities of other, exotic, third world cultures, whatever, or politics. The magazine improved for having done this. Are we on the right track there?
Yeah, well, I would say, yeah, it did improve insofar as it presented some of those more unhappy pictures, but still the predominant quality of the magazine is a very pleasant and upbeat one.
Catherine Lutz is a professor of anthropology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. With Jane Collins of the University of Wisconsin, Catherine Lutz is co-author of Reading National Geographic, recently published by the University of Chicago Press. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio cassette of this discussion. The program is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was Catherine Lutz. She talked about Reading National Geographic, the new book she co-authored about national identity and popular photography. For an audio cassette of this discussion, send $10 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 709. That's program number 709, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again is 27709. Next week, conversations about Chinese culture and politics. My guests will be Frederick Wakeman, a professor of history and director of the Institute of East Asian Studies at the University of California at Berkeley, and Jin Di, a literary translator from the Foreign Languages Institute in the People's Republic of China. Frederick Wakeman will be here to discuss the Chinese-American slave trade during the 19th century. Jin Di will also be on hand to talk about his translation into Chinese of James Joyce's classic work Ulysses. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.